Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and by the way, WNYC political director Andrew Bernstein and I continue our weekly podcast, Digesting Politics Through Election Day. We'll be recording a new one this afternoon. Digesting Politics is a web-only feature that you won't hear on the radio. Sign up for the Digesting Politics podcast for free at WNYC.org. And WNYC's Bob Henley will be covering the conventions, and he joins us now with a preview of some of the protests likely to take place outside the convention walls. And of course, convention time happens to be coming around just as the NYPD has settled a lawsuit filed by protesters who claim their free speech rights were denied during the New York protest just before the Iraq War. And of course, Bob has covered the aftermath of the Republican convention protest arrests here in the city in 2004, which the legal system is still digesting as well. We'll talk about the Deutsche Bank fire report, too. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And let's start locally first in terms of protesters. What's the settlement with the NYPD and the anti-war protesters from 2003?
Right. Basically, the city has agreed to pay $2 million to 52 plaintiffs who were arrested on April 7th, 2003. They were protesting in the immediate response to the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, this was during the period of time that the whole world believed there were weapons of mass destruction, except for, of course, many peace activists who were skeptical. This went through a whole process. They were outside, I guess, the Carlyle Group, which is a private investment firm that has, defense holdings, and they were trying to make these linkages and connections. They were arrested. They got themselves, you know, in this difficult situation with the NYPD. They persisted, and then ultimately, as so often happens with cases with the NYPD and protesters, in the long run, the cops don't have a case that can hold together, and the city ends up settling. We did something about this a while back, about this phenomena of the city paying out these civil claims. In the last few years, over close to $500 million, that's $500 million, that's real money, has been paid out related to issues that have to do with NYPD performance. Unfortunately, so often, there's no lessons learned that come out of it. So,
well, not only no lessons learned, but digging in on the idea that there are no lessons to be learned, because in this case, the NYPD is paying these $2 million, but admitting no wrongdoing.
Exactly. And that, I think, there has to be at some point of accountability, just from the standpoint of, you know, anytime if you're in the private sector, loss prevention, if you're going concern, you pay money out. You want to learn how can we avoid paying it out if it's something that, you know, clearly there are lessons that need to be learned here in terms of how the police on the scene misread what was going on. And, I mean, $2 million, that's a lot of money. And I think more importantly is that this has got to, I assure you that this is being looked at by the lawyers who were in Denver, who work for the city of Denver, and the lawyers who work for the city of St. Paul. Because this, while it's in New York, does set a precedent in terms of what it can cost when law enforcement doesn't understand the Constitution.
So do you know any of the specifics of that? Have the Denver and St. Paul police departments been paying attention to the New York experience and are therefore setting up in a certain way for these coming weeks?
I think that most importantly, we do know, we did confirm the NYPD consulted with these two cities, because certainly there was much that went right during the RNC. They had 600,000 people come in protest. Injuries, I think there was the one injury was an officer knocked off a scooter. That was one injury that occurred. But generally, I mean, the big controversy with the RNC had been the 1,800 individuals that were held, according to the New York Civil Liberties Union, kind of like in preventive detention, who were held. Many of them, the NYCU contends, were abiding by the law, but were basically caught up in these nets, if you will, because there wasn't clear direction. So there's no doubt that the ongoing litigation, there's already been settlements on behalf of some of these protesters by the city. The ongoing litigation costs are considerable. There's no doubt that both Denver and St. Paul are trying to get a lessons learned from it. One of the things I found interesting is, as you know, in 2004, in a very controversial move, the city warehoused these prisoners on a pier that had been used as a bus depot that had all kinds of environmental issues. Subsequently, ironically, some police officers have filed health claims who had to work there. It's very interesting to watch Denver's response. Denver has had problems in the past because of the scale of the city. processing for a number of protesters. They have a local Columbus Day celebration that results in Native Americans getting protested around the issue of Columbus and the issues that that narrative, historical narrative, raises. And they have trouble processing 50 prisoners. So the civil libertarians made the argument. They went into court and said, listen, if you can handle dozens, what are you going to do if you get thousands of protesters? So as a result, the city of Denver went out and took a former, and this is another irony, warehouse for election machines and have retrofitted it, spent $400,000 of their $50 million the federal government gives them to make security preparations, to warehouse individuals who they do arrest and process for a period of time. Now, of course, they are so concerned about the image that they were quick to tell me that it will have air conditioning, it will have toilets, it will have phones. And just yesterday, apparently, they removed the barbed wire from the top of it, and they're going to have community tours. So that's an example of their desire to send a different signal.
All right. Now, also joining us is Lizzie West, who is a New Yorker who's heading out to the Republican convention to make her voice heard outside the convention walls. Lizzie West, thanks for coming on WNYC with us.
Hi, great to be with you all.
Where are you going? What are you going to do?
Well, we're part of a different camp. We're actually setting up on September 1st something called the Tumbleweed Cabaret, which is it's a peace revival concert, and it's a benefit for Code Pink and Organic Consumers Association and Tour of Duty. Two of those organizations are major organizers for the protests at the RNC.
And have you got an official relationship with the city or the RNC or the NYPD out there in terms of, you know, what space you're going to use and when you can use it?
Well, we're doing something outside of the convention walls. And so, no, it's a private show that we're hosting and doing on September 1st to sort of rally all the organizers and give them a space to get ready for the week's activities.
Mm-hmm. Now, I gather that that you did protest the RNC here in New York in 2004. Is that right?
I was there. I wasn't deeply involved, though. I mean, I'm a performance artist who has been touring the country for the last 4 years, and our song 19 Miles to Baghdad has been played a lot on Democracy Now!, and so we've kind of put together this whole performance piece for the RNC. So it's a big event for us.
Right. But that's going to be an indoor event where you have a space, or is that going to be in the street?
It's going to be an indoor event where we have a space.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, it will be after the march on September
1st. But it's going to be an event, you were saying, for a lot of the protest organizers.
Exactly. We want to give everybody a sense of togetherness and unity as they go into the front lines for the week.
So what are you hearing from them? Anything about what they're expecting in terms of, you know, professionalism of the police or anything like that?
I mean, I think everybody is nervous about it, and we're aware of what's going on. But I haven't been deeply connected to all of that kind of uprising right now.
Mm-mm. All right. Lizzie West, performance artist, who will be out doing this event near the RNC in St. Paul, Minnesota. Thanks for coming on with us.
Thank you so much.
And WNYC's Bob Henley still here. We have a post from a listener posting as JS from Mars, by the way, that asks, Bob, is it true that Denver has cleared out a special jail without running water or bathrooms and very high temperatures for the arrestees at Denver?
Well, I think we answered that question before, which is that indeed they're trying to, at least, I haven't been there personally.
They're trying to put out the image that they're doing the
opposite.
Exactly.
In fact, in terms of the RNC in St. Paul, the officer that's responsible for that made public comments that he wanted to make sure that law enforcement did not have the typical SWAT gear that some people consider to be provocative. I mean, there is a thought out there that you can set off a certain vibe if you have people with that kind of ninja armor, we're here to secure order. That can sometimes precipitate a problem. Clearly, the issue here is how well do protesters and the police communicate with each other ahead of time, and how much are expectations realized by both sides. The question of when are people arrested? What constitutes an arrestable offense? That's critical. That's why you want to have like groups like the National Lawyers Guild, the Denver ACLU. Today, later today, the ACLU out in Colorado is having a press conference where, according to them, and I haven't run this to ground, the police are concerned about the stockpiling of things like bricks because that might be used as a weapon. So that's the whole thing you have is how do you deal with the security apparatus at the same time as having the constitutional protected civil liberties in place?
And Justice from Brooklyn, as This person is posting, writes, the host cities usually get insurance indemnification from the political party's host committee, anticipating injury, misbehavior, and police payouts. It happened in New York City and Philly, at least.
Well, what I do know is that certainly New York City has not been able to avail itself of that. If that's a program, the city has been paying these out of the public treasury.
Right.
In the case of St. Paul, I understood that there was, at least from St. Paul's perspective, an innovation because indeed the RNC committee did indemnify them and provide them with some kind of liability waiver where they won't have the same level of. You know, when I spoke with Mayor Bloomberg about this, he was skeptical that would hold up. There's no doubt when you're a law enforcement entity and you're acting in the public, it's very hard to say that you're not, you know, liable for that. One of the challenges for both organizations is that they don't have the sophisticated ability of the NYPD to respond to things. I mean, remember, this city has a history of being able to handle protests. They have like 35,000 officers to draw upon. These are small departments, so they're going to have to kind of ad hoc bring in officers from other suburban departments who may not be nuanced in the challenges of urban policing.
They're going to be New York for a week, for better or worse.
Right.
And commenter HJS writes, how is $2 million anything but a slap on the wrist in terms of this court ruling in New York?
Well, I think that you have to look at the fact at what point is you have to look at the underlying case here, and perhaps we've seen circumstances where some of the things the police, the individual officers represented in the charging documents turned out to be not true. Jim Dwyer has done a lot of great reporting about this.
In the Times.
Right, exactly. When does this society have the strength to say maybe we need to prosecute some of these cases if it's documented and provable that officers, you know, lied on these arresting forms to make the case better than it actually was?
Steve in Greenwood Lake says he'll go to Denver and protest under certain circumstances. Do I have you right, Steve?
Yeah, I figure, you know, they have air conditioning in bathrooms. If they provide spring water and fresh strawberries, you know, I'll get out there.
A swag bag for protesters.
You know, because, you know, I'm getting on in years. You know, I did the Vietnam War thing, you know, and I need some people have to pay attention to my needs.
That's it. Well, maybe Archer Daniels Midland will sponsor a swag bag for protesters.
There we go.
At the jails. Steve, thank you very much. In terms of what protests are scheduled, the newspaper The Independent from the Indy Media Center reports that Twin Cities police are planning for as many as 100,000 demonstrators protesting the Iraq war and lack of social investment on the first day of the RNC, that's September 1st. In Denver, thousands of young people are coming to town for Kent State University. Baby boomers like Steve will remember Kent State University. Kent State is a campus-born initiative that opposes the war and will feature classes and music as an alternative to activities inside the convention center. But, you know, Bob, it's a funny year. I mean, the Republicans would be the normal lightning rods, but the Bush administration is going out of business. And on the Democratic side, they have Barack Obama, who many activist protesters may find a sympathetic figure. So this may not exactly be Chicago 68.
I think that there's also a group called Recreate 68, which has been very strong on the internet. There's the experience group United for Peace and Justice. Also, apparently, Randall Terry, leader of Operation Rescue, is planning an illegal, and it's qualified as that at least, demonstration or sit in on Monday or Tuesday. I think that we should keep in mind that the people that have been anti-war may be a little frustrated because remember they helped elect a Democratic House and there was really no change on the ground. And it appears that the Obama policy about withdrawing from Iraq is putting more troops in Afghanistan. They may feel that that's a difference without a distinction. And in terms of the general drift of the policies, we've seen a situation where what are the Democrats doing? I think they're for offshore drilling. There's a kind of morphing pre-Labor Day where it does appear that the differences are becoming harder to distinguish.
Now, let me take our last 5 minutes here and change topics because just last hour there was a New York City Fire Department news conference on the Deutsche Bank fire 1 year after the tragedy. There's also a Manhattan Attorney General investigation underway as well. You've covered this since the fire itself. So what is the FDNY now saying?
Well, they had what looks like a top-down analysis of what happened on August 18th, and what they found was several issues that have been dogging the FDNY for a long time, particularly the question of radio communications. And there is, you may remember back in 2001, well, even the first World Trade Center attack back in 93, it was well documented they had a problem with radios in high-rise environments. This is a tragic Groundhog Day, where in 2001, according to the 9/11 Commission, the inability of the FDI and radios to work effectively was a contributing factor, not the sole factor, that led to the catastrophic loss of life that day. And what do we see just a year ago? A similar problem with radios. Now, of course, it appears that the analysis put out by the FDNY brass and management puts the onus a little bit on the way the people use the equipment, but there's no doubt that as Glenn Corbett, who is a professor, science professor from firefighting science professor from John Jay, told me weeks ago, the city has not done the basic work of putting the repeaters in high-rise buildings and also in subway environments. And
Even now,
there is still this huge vulnerability. And at the prosecutor, the Manhattan prosecutor, has to do the work and ask the tough question, at what point is repeated bureaucratic failure to act on a known problem rise to criminal neglect? And that's the issue.
Criminal negligence. At what point does that become a matter of criminal neglect when they know that people are dying from
exactly
this problem?
Exactly.
Is that the basis of Attorney General DA Morgenthau's investigation?
It's much broader than that, because also we had the miasma of jurisdictional questions. The LMDC, one of the things that came out in this report was they were not required to getting a demolition permit. That whole question of there's several hundred buildings like the Deutsche Bank building that was owned by the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation that are owned by other entities that aren't required to abide by New York City fire codes. And so we still have any day a situation where that's the case. Take the UN, for instance, even all the Port Authority structures. So there's still a jurisdictional challenge. The bottom line is, though, someone needs to take personal responsibility for this, because clearly we can't continue to go in this direction.
So this new FDNY report, does it beg the question of potential criminal negligence? Does it beg the question of why they don't have this radio communication, an interdepartmental radio communication with the police and other emergency services that we certainly heard a lot about after 9/11, why they still don't have it in place all these years later?
Well, they have made a progress, apparently, with interoperability between the police and FDNY, but these issues germane just to the fire department still exist. The union has pushed back and said that management is not taking responsibility for the fact that leadership on something like this comes from the top. There was no clear firefighting plan for the Deutsche Bank building. And so there is the sense that someone at the top needs to take responsibility, because it's costing people's lives.
I'll tell you one thing, though. I want to be Morgenthau when I grow up. 89 years old and still banging at the bad guys.
Right.
We have 1 minute left.
Sure.
Let's go back to the convention.
Sure.
How are you going to be covering protesters in Denver and St. Paul? What are you going to be looking for?
Well, it's going to be the quality of communication between the police and protesters to get into those conferences they don't want you to be in, to see who's keeping their word and who shows discipline. Because protesters have a responsibility when they're in public to show discipline and keep their word, and so does law enforcement. If you get into a situation where you find bad actors on either side, and you could have a confluence where that happens on both sides, you've got a problem.
And there are occasions where some subgroups of protesters go out specifically to cause trouble, they think that that's going to be the only way to draw meaningful attention to their cause.
Well, the stakes couldn't be higher for the Democrats. I think it's important to keep in mind, we talk about 1968, those images of the violence that happened there really set the agenda, and it trumped and eclipsed Hubert Humphrey's nomination. It also resulted, I might add, Nixon carried Illinois. Colorado's a swing state. The Democratic Convention is a neighbor. And so the degree which people feel that it was a bad show or that people were hurt, it wasn't badly managed, it makes the guy who's coming in who has an experience gap problem look bad.
Colorado and Minnesota are both swing states this year, and guess what? That's why the parties have chosen to hold their conventions there. WNYC's Bob Henley, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
See you out in both places.
Great.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.